Isaiah began to prophesy in the year that King Uzziah died. Uzziah lived, or reigned, sorry, for 52 years, which is even longer than Queen Elizabeth II. And he was a better king than average. Wasn't brilliant, but he was one of the better kings of Judah. But he died. And most of the kings of Judea were actually bad kings. And the good ones, like Uzziah, died, just like the bad ones did. And their successors were often bad. Uzziah's successors were very bad. One of them was called Ahaz, and he offered his son as a sacrifice to a pagan god. And the story of Israel's monarchy is much the same as the story of the British monarchy, a mixture of villains, lunatics, womanizers, complete non-entities, with the occasional high point, usually a queen, in the case of Britain, although not in the case of Israel. We need to bear in mind that a good or a bad king really did make a lot of difference in those days. Kings had total power. And like our monarchs who reign but don't rule, kings in the ancient world ruled. And therefore the happiness of a nation depended in great measure on the character and the wisdom of the king. Which is why when Israel first asked for a king, like the other nations, God granted their request very reluctantly. And only after warning them what to expect from a future king. You can read about it in 1 Samuel chapter 8, you needn't turn to it, but basically, when the people ask God for a king, God says to them, "This is what the king who reigns over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, others to plough his ground and reap his harvest, still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants, your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not listen to you on that day." So be very, very careful before you have a king, God said to Israel. If you give a sinful human being absolute power over other human beings, you can expect trouble. And this is why the law of Moses made absolutely clear that kings were to be under the law of God, not above it. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Again, you needn't turn to it unless you really want to. Deuteronomy chapter 17. "Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. The king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. He is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law from that of the priests who are Levites. It is to be with him and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left." So God made it absolutely clear in the law of Moses that kings were to be under his law, not above it. And we must bear in mind also the importance of the king of Israel. Israel wasn't just any nation, it was the chosen nation. It was chosen to be a light to the nations. Israel was supposed to be the agent of God's blessing and salvation to the nations. And therefore the king of Israel represented Israel and led Israel, and he was to be a model of this obedience and this godliness, so that if Israel brought blessing and salvation to the nations, it would be largely through the king of Israel that this blessing and this salvation came. So, in response to Israel's insistent demand for a king, God granted their request. And the first king of Israel was Saul. Outwardly very impressive, outwardly just the sort of man you would expect a king to look like. He was head and shoulders over his fellow Israelites, it says. And after a promising start, he turned out to be a complete disaster. He turned out to be a curse rather than a blessing. He was persistently disobedient. Eventually the Spirit of God left him, and he ended his reign in spiritism and suicide. So that was the first king of Israel. Not a very promising start. Well, maybe Saul's successor, David, would be the chosen king who would lead Israel and the world to salvation and to blessing. Well, certainly David was more promising than Saul, and in many ways he was the ideal for future kings of Israel. In the book of Kings, the writer often summarizes the reign of different kings, and he says he walked in the ways of his father David, or he didn't walk in the ways of his father David. David was the sort of standard for future kings to follow. He defeated Israel's enemies, particularly that Philistine champion, Goliath. He made Jerusalem the capital city. He brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. And he wanted to build a house for God and for the Ark. God didn't let him build the house, the temple. Instead, he promised to build a house for David. And by a house, of course, he meant a dynasty, like the House of Windsor, the House of David. And this dynasty would rule Israel forever. Even if David's sons went astray, God would be faithful to his covenant, and he would not remove his love from the House of David. You can find that in 2 Samuel chapter 7. In many ways, David, as I say, was an ideal king, the ideal king, but sadly, towards the end of his reign, he succumbed to adultery, and his reign fizzled out and ended in family rebellion and sordid intrigue. So David wasn't the fulfillment of God's promises. But what about his son, the son of David? In many ways, Solomon was a partial fulfillment, a shadow of what was to come. In the reign of Solomon, Israel reached the highest point that she ever reached. Solomon asked for wisdom from God so that he could reign well. He built that temple that David wanted to build. He extended the borders of Israel further than they've ever been extended before. His wealth and his splendor were famous. He had a navy. He even built a navy. Israel wasn't usually a ship-going nation, but Solomon built a navy, and exotic goods from the nations were brought into Jerusalem. The Queen of Sheba, she had a state visit to Jerusalem, and it took her breath away. And she said, "The half has not been told." Surely Solomon was the king who would bring blessing to the nations. Well, I'm afraid not. Far from the Gentiles coming to worship God in Jerusalem during the reign of Solomon, Solomon brought Gentile wives to Jerusalem. He married many, many wives, far too many. More than one is too many, actually. Far too many. And they were pagans. They were from foreign countries, and they were for the purpose of political alliances. And these queens came to live in Jerusalem, and they had to bring their foreign gods with them. And so temples were built in Jerusalem for foreign gods, alongside the temple of God himself. And Solomon's extravagance, of course, had to be paid for by burdensome taxation. And his building projects had to be built by slave labor. And Solomon accumulated the very things that the law of Moses told us that kings were not allowed to accumulate. Gold and silver and horses and so on. And in fact, Solomon did the very things that God warned Israel about in 1 Samuel chapter 8. So Solomon wasn't the promised king. His foolish son Rehoboam was even worse. His oppressive policies led to civil war in the nation. And the 10 northern tribes split away from Rehoboam. They chose a rival king called Jeroboam. They had a rival capital city, Samaria. And this left the sons of David, the kings of Judah, ruling over only two tribes, the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, in the south with the capital at Jerusalem. The kings of Israel in the north were a thoroughly bad lot. And in any case, they were illegitimate, they weren't sons of David. Most of them had very short reigns, one of them only reigned for 1 week. Many of them were assassinated. The low point, of course, was King Ahab with his Gentile wife Jezebel. And in spite of faithful prophets like Elijah and Elisha and Amos and Hosea, things spiraled out of control. And in 721 BC, to be precise, 721 years before the Lord Jesus Christ came, the Assyrian Empire invaded the northern part, Israel, the 10 tribes in the north, destroyed Samaria, deported the population, where they disappeared, intermarried with Gentiles, disappeared, and that was the end of Israel. And it wasn't much better in Judah. There were occasional good kings, like Uzziah, who died, and the trouble was that their sons didn't often follow in their father's footsteps. And Ahaz, who was, I think, either the son or the grandson of Uzziah, was a particularly bad king, and he was the king who reigned during the first part of Isaiah's prophetic career. Manasseh was even worse. And Jewish tradition says that Isaiah was actually killed by the king Manasseh. That's not in the Bible, but it's a tradition in Judaism. And eventually, as Isaiah predicted, the Babylonians invaded Judah, they besieged Jerusalem, they eventually destroyed the walls of Jerusalem, they destroyed the temple, they deported the population of Judah, and the last king of Judah, Zedekiah, whose name means the Lord our righteousness, or the Lord is righteous, Zedekiah. The last thing that happened to him was that his eyes were put out after he had watched the murder of his sons. So ended the monarchy. So ended the monarchy of Judah. Instead of leading the way to the blessing of the nations, they were more of a curse than a blessing. And we look in vain in the Old Testament for a king who will fulfill God's covenant promises. So has God's promise failed? Never, says Isaiah. The tree of the monarchy may have been felled, but there's life in the stump. And from the stump of Jesse, a shoot will come up. Chapter 11, verse 1 of Isaiah. Shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The king will come. And I'm sure you know that in the days of King Ahaz, a thoroughly bad king, Isaiah foretold a royal birth. Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders. There's a royal birth coming, says Isaiah. His name will be Emmanuel, which means God with us. And in chapter 9 we have various other titles of this royal child. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. These are his kingly titles, his royal title. And in chapter 11, he gives us more detail about this coming king. His character, verses 2 and 3. His character, what will this king be like? Well, he will be characterized by wisdom, just as Solomon was. Only a far greater wisdom than Solomon. Solomon's wisdom very definitely fizzled out. It's not at all wise to have 700 wives and 300 concubines. Solomon had a reputation for wisdom, but his wisdom wasn't all that brilliant. Here is a truly wise king. Verse 2. Wisdom, understanding, counsel, knowledge, and the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. And this king will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. Nothing will please him more than fearing the Lord. He will be anointed by the Spirit. And the Hebrew word for someone who's anointed is the word Messiah. And the Greek word for somebody who is anointed is the word Christos. And the English version of that is the word Christ. Anointed one. King. He will be anointed by the Spirit. The Spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, it says. It will never leave him like it left Saul. Wisdom. Justice. Verses 3 and 5. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. Verse 5, righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash round his waist. He will reign with absolute fairness, absolute impartiality. He won't be swayed by mere outward appearance. He won't act purely on the basis of hearsay. He won't be impressed by the rich or the powerful. He won't be able to bribe this king. He will take on the cause of the poor and the needy. Verse 4. With righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. What a king. Don't we need a king like that? With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. Political leaders usually manage to act on behalf of the rich. Here is a king who will act on behalf of the poor of the earth, the downtrodden. Justice, wisdom, justice, righteousness will be his belt, faithfulness his sash. Here is a good king, a king we can trust. And power, verse 4. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. A wise and a just king isn't much use if he's got no power. If he can be easily toppled and replaced by some wicked tyrant. But there's no fear of that with this king. His throne is absolutely secure. Those who oppose his good and just rule will perish. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. His power will be exercised on behalf of truth and righteousness and goodness. So, that's the character of this king. What about the effects of his reign? Verses 6 to 10. The effects of his reign. Universal peace and safety and security. His reign is pictured beautifully in verses 6 to 10. Instinctive, natural, aggressive enemies living in peace and harmony with one another. Their natures completely transformed. Wolves normally tear lambs to pieces. I mean, wolves aren't like lions. At least a lion will just bite the neck of its victim or give it just one great strike with its claws and it's over. A wolf will bite a lamb to bits. Leopards normally stalk and pounce upon a goat. A goat doesn't have a chance with a leopard. Lions maul cows. They're not safe with such creatures. the cobra and the viper, mankind. One bite from one of these snakes and a child is poisoned, so you don't let him play near the viper's hole. You certainly don't let him put his hand down the viper's hole. And here, these creatures are pictured living with each other, lying down with each other, playing with each other, a little child leading them, a toddler playing near the snake's hole and putting his little hand in the snake's hole. Here at last is peace. Here at last is safety. Here at last is security. The end of all cruelty and aggression and war. Is this literal or is it figurative? Well, make your own minds up. This passage is full of poetry, it's full of imagery. Verse 1 is an image. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. That's not literally. Jesus isn't a shoot from a stump or a branch. That's poetry. Verse 5 is poetry. Righteousness will be his belt. Faithfulness the sash round his waist. Verse 4 is poetry. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. Your mouth isn't a rod. Verse 10. The root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the people. Jesus isn't a banner. He isn't a flag. This passage is full of imagery, isn't it? And therefore to insist that verses 6 to 10 must be literal is just ridiculous. Even if it is literal, surely the main point is that if the rule of this king changes the nature of beasts like this, then his rule will certainly change the nature of human beings. What is it that brings about this peace? Well, verse 9, it's the knowledge of the Lord. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It's not animals that have the knowledge of the Lord, it's human beings that have the knowledge of the Lord. It's the knowledge of the Lord which is producing this peace, this harmony in this passage. Well, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And for all I know, there may be lions and cows and snakes in the new heaven and the new earth. I don't know. And this could well turn out to be literal as well as poetic. But I'm sure the main thrust of it here is that it's a poetic description of beautiful harmony and safety and security and peace. So the character of the king, the effects of his reign, peace and harmony, and the extent of his reign, the extent of his reign, verses 10 down to the end of the passage. He will be a banner, verse 10, for the peoples. The nations will rally to him. The peoples, the nations will come to this king. The exiles will return. There will be a new exodus. Just as there was an exodus from Egypt, there will be an exodus from the east, from Assyria, from Babylon. Just as the Red Sea dried up, so the Euphrates River will dry up. Verse 15, the Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea. With a scorching wind he will sweep his hand over the Euphrates River. And the exiles will return. They'll return to this king. Now, there was a literal return from the exile in Babylonia. But it was only a small, insignificant thing. And nor is the modern state of Israel the fulfillment of this passage. No kings are involved in this return to the land of Israel. Certainly not King Jesus. It's a purely political, militaristic thing. Nuclear weapons are actually involved. It is the exact opposite of what we read in Isaiah chapter 11. No. This is God's people from all the nations Jew and Gentile, rallying to a king. And there are plenty of other passages in the Old Testament along similar lines. Micah chapter 5, which even gives the place of his birth, Bethlehem. Daniel chapter 7, a son of man, with all nations worshipping him, bowing the knee to him. Psalms about a coming king. And the Old Testament ends without this king having come. But the New Testament opens with the birth of a baby. And it's a royal birth. There's a long genealogy at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel. And it's only kings that have long genealogies. And this king, Jesus, is called the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. He's born in Bethlehem. And what does the angel Gabriel say to his mother, Mary, when he announces his birth to her? You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end. Here at last is the King of Israel, the King that the prophets proclaimed. And Magi from the east saw his star and came looking for him, saying, "Where is the King of the Jews?" And when Jesus began his ministry, his message was, "The time has come. The kingdom of God is here." And cynical Nathanael, when introduced to Jesus by his friend Philip, said to Jesus, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus is the King of Israel. And he's no ordinary king. He didn't live in a palace. He didn't even live in Jerusalem. And he didn't strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. And he didn't slay the wicked with the breath of his lips. So is he this king? He actually said he'd come to serve. And far from wolves lying down with lambs, this king was surrounded by wild beasts. Psalm 22. Wild beasts surrounded him, tore him to pieces on the cross. But he gave us some parables, which he called parables of the kingdom. And in the parables of the kingdom, we learn that the kingdom comes to this world in two stages. Just as the harvest comes in two stages. There's the sowing, and then there's the reaping, and there's an interval between the two stages. And the sowing is a very insignificant event. And the seed is very vulnerable. And so Jesus came the first time, King Jesus came the first time to sow the seed of the kingdom, and it meant laying down his life for his subjects. You see, Jesus was Israel's king. And kings have to take responsibility for their people. And Israel deserved to be punished for her sin. And therefore the King of Israel took the responsibility for Israel. And on the cross, he, the King of Israel, took the responsibility for Israel's sins. They even put a placard over him on the cross. "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." He was the King of the Jews. He is the King of the Jews. And he was representing Israel there on the cross. He was taking responsibility for Israel's sins. And now Israel's sins have been paid for, and she can be redeemed. And of course, Gentiles have always been welcome into Israel. Even in the Old Testament, Gentiles were welcome to become part of the people of Israel. And a few did. Ruth, Rahab, Uriah the Hittite, all became part of Jerusalem, all became part of Israel. And Gentiles are invited to become part of Israel today. And many millions have. So now there are actually more Gentiles in Israel than there are Jews. And you become part of Israel by submitting to the King of Israel, Jesus. He is the King of Israel. And when a Gentile submits to the King of Israel and begins to worship the God of Israel, he becomes part of the people of Israel. Jesus is the King of Israel. And he has redeemed Israel by his death on the cross. And when this gospel of the kingdom has been proclaimed to all nations, the king will come again. Just as the farmer will come to the field again, not to sow the seed, but to harvest the seed. The king will come again, and he will come not to suffer. He will come not to serve. He will come to rule in wisdom and in justice and in power and in peace. And what a wonderful day that will be when the king comes again. And we need to look forward to that day. And we need to ask ourselves, will I be part of that kingdom? I'll tell you how you can tell whether you'll be part of that kingdom then. Are you in his kingdom now? Have you bowed to his rule today? Those who bow to his rule today will be part of his kingdom then. So, thank God for fulfilling his promises to give us his king. And perhaps next Sunday night we'll look at another Old Testament passage, I'm not quite sure which yet, which will give us another facet to God's faithfulness in keeping his promises in the Old Testament. All the promises of God are yes and amen in Jesus Christ.